嘅環境之中去完結呢個節目啦。咁、
啊、
我都想同大家講下香港大學鬼故、啊，不過我諗留翻下次啦呢啲。
好啊。
係啊，大概十月裡面仲有幾個禮拜，兩個禮拜可以講。我哋會同大家分享好多
好
恐怖嘅故事。
今日嘅
我哋好黑暗嘅環境，我哋陣間會 post 我哋依家嘅現場俾大家睇。
係啦，同大家開心 share。
唔知點解你停個電，我哋依家係漆黑一片。
系啦，我哋靠电脑嘅灯光照到我哋嘅房间。
都系一个问题。
系啦，
冇错。
我哋安唔安全打不出 UC 都系一个问题。
系啦，哇，大家都好惊慌啊！
莫非大家
好惊惊？
因为通常入到嚟就出
翻嚟，好惊惊。
好，咁我哋今个礼拜节目
完啦，
完。
While treating a Liberian man who died from it.
Town in northern Syria and the eventual outcome of the battle as strategic, even though it's located right near the border of Turkey, a NATO member. The Pentagon spokesman said Kobane could still fall, even though the airstrikes had killed several hundred jihadist fighters. But he stressed that the military operation against Islamic State in Syria and Iraq was bigger than one town.
Brazilian police have uncovered a huge child pornography network hidden in the dark web, a virtual world not visible to most internet users. The year-long operation was launched simultaneously in 18 Brazilian states and in the Federal District of Brasilia. A police statement said they'd arrested 55 people. The police said during the operation they'd rescued six children from various places across the country. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has described President Obama's attitude to Russia as hostile. In an interview with a Serbian newspaper, Mr. Putin accused the United States of trying to blackmail Moscow with sanctions over Ukraine, but said he hoped Washington would realize that this was futile. He said the U.S. was trying to interfere in Russia's domestic affairs and urged Washington to think of the consequences. One of America's best-selling novelists, John Grisham, has criticized the U.S. justice system for handing down harsh prison sentences to people who view child pornography. Mr. Grisham told a British newspaper that American judges had, as he put it, gone crazy on incarceration. James Earle reports.
John Grisham made the comments during an interview in which he criticised the American justice system and the high number of people in US prisons. He says the jails are full of men his age who got online one night, had too much to drink, pushed the wrong buttons and got into child porn. The author of legal thrillers such as The Firm and Time to Kill also says his good buddy from law school was jailed for 3 years in Canada for viewing child porn. He said he had no sympathy for what he called real paedophiles, who he said should be locked up.
Votes are being counted in Mozambique after presidential and parliamentary elections on Wednesday. Voting had to be extended at some polling stations to allow people queuing outside them to cast their votes. Local media said there was a large turnout in polls, which were described as largely peaceful by Southern African election observers. Members of Parliament in the Solomon Islands are receiving huge payouts because of an irreversible mistake by finance officials ahead of elections later this month. The MPs are getting termination payments of $53,000 each as their terms come to an end before the poll. The sum is four times as much as they were given when Parliament was last dissolved in 2010. BBC News.
Thanks, John. Hello. Welcome to Newsday from the BBC with Julian Keane and Bola Mosra.
The latest Ebola case in the US, an interview with Afghanistan's First Lady, and the murder of two British tourists that has become a strain on relations between Thailand and Myanmar. Our main topics over the next half hour here on Newsday. Marie Keyworth will join us with the business news, and Ed Harry has the sports headlines for us. The epicentre of the Ebola outbreak might be in West Africa, but it's the presence of the disease on American soil that's now got the US government really worried. It started with the death of a Liberian national at a Dallas hospital last week, and now a second nurse who treated him has also tested positive for Ebola.
The worry here is how much contact she had with other people, especially given the fact that she flew to Cleveland, Ohio and back. That return flight was made just a day before being diagnosed with the disease. The nurse has been named as Amber Vincent, has since been placed in isolation. Kurt Lewis is a journalist with KRLD in Dallas. So what do we know about the nurse's current state of health?
Julian, as far as we know, no one's releasing her specific information. We do know she has been transferred to a significant hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, out of state. This is a hospital that has already treated several Ebola patients who have survived. So obviously they have the cutting edge in technology and skills there.
She flew, as I understand it, to Cleveland from Dallas on Friday. On the Monday, she made the return trip. Even though she had a small fever, you do wonder, how was that possible?
We have learned today that she did, in fact, Amber Vincent did, in fact, contact CDC for advice because she was running this low-grade fever, 99.5, and we have been told through CBS News that the CDC gave her the go-ahead, or at least did not tell her she could not fly, that 99.5 was below the threshold of 100.4, which they have set.
That's CDC, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who are now looking into monitoring the situation regarding the passengers on the flight she took. As I understand it, they've got an emergency number they can call.
That is correct. And we're told there's something on the order of 130 passengers who may have been on that flight with her.
I'm just looking at the front page of the online version of the Dallas Morning News, saying that healthcare workers treating that Liberian national who later died at the Dallas hospital for 2 days while they were treating him apparently were not wearing these hazmat or protective suits.
That's what we have learned as well. Apparently, they did not realize he had Ebola, or they didn't realize he had come from a country that was part of the outbreak. It's kind of shocking given all of the publicity about that outbreak in Africa, but that is apparently the case. They didn't know or they were not aware that they could be putting their own lives in danger.
Kurt, with this drip of information and now Dallas very much in the public spotlight, what's the mood? Is there concern? Is there fear?
Well, I think it's more anger as much as anything else. You know, if you listen to the chat shows where regular citizens call in and vent their views, I mean, people are just angry that the government has not, the federal government has not taken steps to seal off flights from the countries in West Africa that are affected by this. Once somebody gets into the country, then you know this is what we see. It begins to spread from person to person. So I think it's more anger than fear that the government hasn't taken more stringent measures to seal off the airport, so to speak.
So he's Kurt Lewis, and he's a journalist based in Dallas. And the latest case there seems to mirror another case, that one involving a nurse in Spain, infected while caring for another patient, a priest who had the disease. These latest developments have called into question the protocols used to keep health workers safe, protocols which should include the wearing of protective equipment. Alistair Leithead visited the National Biocontainment Training Center in Galveston in Texas to try on a biohazard suit and see just how hard it is to guarantee the safety of Ebola doctors and nurses.
We're going to slip your legs into some coveralls. So make sure you pull your feet all the way through.
Now what's this and how does this work?
Sure, this is a PAP, or a powered air purifying respirator. This is going to be run by the battery around your waist, and it is going to draw in potentially contaminated air from the room through the filter, providing you with clean filtered air.
Okay.
How does that feel?
That feels great, yep.
Next, we're going to put on a pair of gloves.
Cute. It's quite hard to feel things
it
with
is.
The gloves on, isn't
and
it?
And you only have one pair. We're going to put another pair on.
Okay, yeah.
Now, when entering a patient room, we would also put a gown over this as well. That way, when you're working in the patient room, in case your gown becomes contaminated, you have a layer that you can safely remove in the room, but you still have protective gear on underneath. And we are going to duct tape your gloves to your Tyvek.
That seals that completely together, the glove.
That's
and
right.
The suit, I suppose.
Exactly.
The key thing being that if I was to go into a room and was to come into contact with bodily fluids from someone who was suffering from Ebola, I could take these gloves off, I could take this front piece, the gown, I could take that off.
But you're still protected, underneath.
Below. So where does it go from here?
So once you were done, we would then start the decontamination phase and the step down to getting out of the room.
Presumably that's a pretty important part of the process.
That is the most important part of the process.
Is getting out.
Is doffing your, or taking off your PPE properly. Without contaminating other parts.
All right, let's do it then.
So the first thing that we're going to do is I'm just going to do a fine spray all over you.
Okay.
You want to remove your gloves in a way that you're not contaminating underneath. So you want to pinch, there you go, and we're going to turn them inside out. So dirty side in, clean side out, yep.
Oh, because I've already contaminated
myself.
Oh,
is right. That's what this is for.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now we're going to remove your gown. Okay, now let's stop here.
Ooh.
Stop. Touch.
Don't touch.
No
spray.
Spray.
You really have to...
You have to think before you do it.
And yeah.
That's
you really
right.
have to concentrate on where you're putting your hand.
And you think
if
before
I'm imagining that everything on the front here could be infected.
Exactly. You need to remove your duct tape first, but not your gloves.
Now, there's some skin showing there, isn't there? So I've got to be really careful here.
Now we're going to take off your Tyvek.
Okay, and that's off.
And you're out.
And straight in to wash your hands.
Straight to wash your hands.
All right. Thank you very much for showing me. How did I do?
Excellent.
Not terribly well, my first go, I don't think.
No, but you see how it is. You have to kind of think before you do something. And it's about practice.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In Afghanistan, tradition dictates that leaders' wives stay out of the public eye, but no one seems to have told the country's new First Lady, Rula Ghani. During the presidential campaign, she was the only candidate's wife to appear in public. And when her husband, Ashraf Ghani, after winning the election, paid an emotional tribute to his wife in his inauguration speech, well, it became a big talking point across the country. Rula Ghani is not just in the public eye, she's also speaking out. The BBC Afghan Service's Sana Safi has been to meet her. So what's she like?
The First Lady was really nice, kind, observant, very friendly and ordinary.
And how big a deal is it for her to sort of go public and be speaking to the media like this?
I think it's a bigger deal for her and for Afghanistan. For her, because she has been in and out of the country for the last 40 years. And second, she's Lebanese, not Afghan. And third, this is the first time after 1959 that a woman in such a position is coming out and speaking about women rights and about child rights and what she's planning to do about the country and how she's planning to help Afghans to rely less on aid and stand on their two feet, and how she will be there to cheer them on and see their success.
And indeed, you addressed all sorts of issues, even her private life, so to speak. I mean, here's what she had to say, for example, about her parents' view of her marriage.
Well, my mother would have liked me to marry the boy next door or something like that, you know. But my father, he was a very traditional person, and yet he had an open mind as far as I was concerned. And I would love for all Afghan men to become like my father or like my husband, that to allow women to let them do what they're asking to. My father came to Afghanistan with me when I came here the first time. Met with the family, and then, you know, that meant we got engaged.
It's not every day you hear an Afghan woman in a position of power, of influence, speaking so candidly about what is a lot of people like to keep pretty private.
That's right. She was very open about her private life and the fact that they married for love. When I asked her how she convinced them, and then she said, well, I told them he's the man I want to marry and he's the man I want to be with, even though his family is miles away from Lebanon. So she was very frank about that, and she wants everyone to be like her husband. You can see the love she has for her husband in her eyes when she's talking about him.
Was it surprising to hear the president, in effect, pay tribute to her during his inauguration speech? Because in a sense, that was really putting the spotlight on her and putting her center stage.
It was surprising for Afghans, particularly men and those who have conservative views. But for her, she said that that's how her husband is. So when he's talking about improving women's rights, he really means it.
She's not the average Afghan wife, though. I mean, for a start, she's the wife of the president. But also, as you point out, she was born and raised in Lebanon. Has she been absolutely accepted by everyone in Afghanistan?
When I spoke to her and I asked her about the family she had been with, her in-laws, she said it was very easy. Yes, she's not Afghan, she's Lebanese, but still, for Afghans, she's not a Khariji, like a typical Westerner. She's just someone from another, well, Muslim Christian country.
A lot of us, of course, waiting to see what she's going to do next over the next few years. When she spoke to you, she outlined, she gave you a little sense of...
Nigeria have kept their qualification hopes alive. They won 3-1 at home to Sudan in Abuja, their first victory of this qualifying campaign after taking just a point from their opening three matches. Former Ferrari president Luca de Montezemolo has told Italian television Fernando Alonso will be leaving the Ferrari Formula One team at the end of the season. His departure has been widely expected. And the Kansas City Royals baseball team have reached the World Series for the first time since 1985.
Thanks very much, Ed. Now, the parents of two Burmese migrant workers accused of killing British tourists, Hannah Witheridge and David Miller, have been talking to the BBC. Now, they say their sons are being made scapegoats by Thai authorities. The bodies of the British pair were found on a beach on the island of Koh Tao a month ago. From Myanmar, joining us now is our correspondent, Jonah Fisher, who's been speaking to the parents. Jonah, greetings to you. What have the parents of these Burmese men, what have they been saying to you?
Well, the parents have come here to Yangon to get passports because they are on their way to Thailand. They hope to speak directly with these two men, Win Zaw Tun and Zaw Lin, who've been arrested and charged with the murder of these two British tourists. Now, I spoke to them. It was a very emotional discussion. I showed them some of the footage of the reenactment, which had their two sons taking part on the beach where the murder had taken place. They cried, they wept, and perhaps as you'd expect, they reiterated time after time that they were not the sort of boys who would carry out a brutal murder like this, that they'd gone there simply for work, that they were sending their money back for the family back in Western Myanmar. And they categorically said they must have been set up by the Thai authorities. There's no way our boys could have done this.
I mean, and it's not just the parents, is it? I mean, aren't there others who are also talking with questionable terms about the Thai authorities and how they're conducting this investigation?
That's right. You'd expect the parents to say that their sons aren't guilty of this murder, but there are much broader concerns from human rights groups who've been watching the investigation closely, and also from diplomats, in particular British diplomats, who've been following the case closely. They have serious misgivings about the way the Thai police have handled this. There have been a steady stream of Burmese migrant workers who were working on that island saying that they were beaten by the Thai police to try and get them to give some sort of incriminating evidence. So lots of question marks, and lots of people who've been watching this case say it all just seems a little bit convenient that this murder took place on this island in Thailand and they've blamed it on outsiders. That is a convenient solution to a problem, and that perhaps they don't have the sort of evidence which they claim to have against these two men.
So the reaction, I mean, as you say, you've said what the human rights and others agencies are saying in Myanmar. What about in Thailand and the whole reaction to the murders themselves?
There are lots of misgivings in Thailand as well, particularly from, as I said, their human rights groups, Burmese migrant activist groups. Here in Myanmar, of course, these two men are Burmese, so there has been a lot of concern about them. But the Thai police have in the past had something of a track record of finding Burmese migrant workers responsible for awful crimes, which they're finding very difficult to solve. And many people are saying it's just too convenient that after nearly a month of not solving this crime, they managed to suddenly come up with what they say is extremely damning evidence against these two Burmese men. And yet there really seems to be very little motive as to why these two young Burmese men who were working on the island of Koh Tao should have so brutally murdered these two British tourists.
Jonah, thanks for joining us. Our correspondent, Jonah Fisher there.
Business news and quite a lot of turbulence in the share markets across Europe and the United States. Marie Keyworth from our business desk is with us. Marie, I mean, first of all, you know, why is this happening? And crucially, what sort of impact could this have?
Well, yes, the latest is that shares in Japan have now fallen by more than 2% in opening trading after these similar falls we've seen in Europe and the US. Now, overall, it's because of analysts are saying the prospect of Eurozone falling back into recession, the global slowdown more generally, and a fresh political crisis in Greece that's driven Europe's main share markets down by nearly 2-3%, depending on which country you're looking at. Now, in London, about $73 billion were wiped off the value of British British top companies. Now, this background of poor growth around the world has been around for a while. So why are we seeing this shock now? I asked Diane Fertgott-Roth, who is a former economic advisor to President George W. Bush.
We have to ask ourselves what happened today that didn't happen the past couple of days. We got new retail sales figures for America, which showed that spending in September was down rather than up as predicted. And I think that that also led to the loss of confidence and the sell-off. There's also ISIS, there's also Ebola. And one might ask, what do these have to do with the stock markets? But I think these continue to have the effect that people don't have confidence in our government. You know, the government makes an announcement saying ISIS must be stopped, Ebola must be stopped, but then we hear about the second or third person in America who has caught it, despite the precautions of the Centers for Disease Control. So I think it's a number of factors. And it's also the fact that the markets have been relatively high in America for the past few months. There have been substantial gains. And what we're seeing now is partly a technical correction.
Now, that's Diana Fertgott-Roth talking there.
You got some news today about Botswana and, I think, some problems with its past, I say its power station.
Indeed, you'd be right in that, because Botswana has only one power station. It's called Moropuli B, and it has broken down, apparently, due to boiler leaks and generator failures. Now, this leaves the country entirely dependent on power imports from its neighbour, South Africa. And you might recall that South Africa's main energy provider, the state-owned company Eskom, isn't in the best of health itself. The company has already been struggling to provide enough electricity for its home market, and actually earlier this year has been forced to announce rolling blackouts to cope with demand. So the outlook's not particularly rosy for either South Africa or Botswana either.
Some movement also in the world of media. I think it's what to do with, was it,
yeah,
video streaming?
So. Indeed, Netflix is a name you might recognise. It's where you can stream TV programmes over the internet. They've had a bit of a bad showing. They've had fewer subscribers this year than they were expecting, and the news has sent their shares down 25%. Now, their competitor, HBO, who make programmes like Game of Thrones, one of their more popular ones, has announced that it's dislocating itself from cable contracts, which means that you will actually be able to stream programs directly through HBO, and a new thing that they're launching there. So competition for Netflix as well.
Thanks, Marie.
And I wonder whether nature programmes will be the type that you can stream there, because one thing you might want to know about is kangaroos. We know they hop, right? Well, actually, perhaps not, because consider this. A long, long time ago, we're talking about 30,000 years ago, there existed a family of giant kangaroos that walked on 2 feet and found it really hard to hop. Paleontologist Christine Janis, who led the study into the extinct group of kangaroos, explains.
They had an anatomy that was not as specialised as modern fast-hopping kangaroos, like the red and grey kangaroo. And they had various features that particularly informed me that they couldn't have done easily the kind of slow walk on all fours using the tail that modern kangaroos do. They had a very stiff back and very specialized hands. So it seemed to me that if they couldn't do that, and hopping slowly is actually not possible in terms of biomechanics, that they must have done something else. And there are lots of aspects about their anatomy in terms of the details of the bones that were unlike modern kangaroos, but altogether added up to the idea that they could have supported their weight on one leg at a time.
Too big to hop. That was their problem. You're with Newsday here on the BBC World Service.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programs you've missed. Or you can access